Hello, and welcome to Ag Tech Talk, Agribusiness Global's podcast exploring the latest technology, innovations, tools, and services that are moving the crop input community forward. I'm your host, Dan Jacobs, Senior Editor with Agribusiness Global. Each episode, we talk with industry experts to learn their insights on ag tech solutions being developed around the world and how they could impact your business. Whether it's agricultural technology you'll find in the field, on a tablet, or in the air, we'll talk about it here. Today, we're talking with Todd Hauser, co-founder and CEO of Trillium Ag, a biotechnology company that developed a nanotechnology platform that can be used to target specific pests. It gets pretty complicated and there's lots of science involved. We'll let Todd explain it. Todd, thanks for being here with us.
Well, thank you, Dan. First of all, thank you for having me this morning. It's a pleasure to be here and share Trillium Ag with you and your listeners. And, you know, Trillium is built on a platform that I'm particularly excited about because it took us a number of years to scientifically validate this methodology. And Trillium Ag is built on a platform that utilizes RNA and naturally derived proteins in a combination that I think really mimics what nature provides in terms of natural crop protection methodologies. And we found a way to sort of embrace that, engineer it, and continue on with this use of naturally derived proteins and RNA to really overcome some of the traditional challenges that we see. Most importantly, it's a safe, sustainable technology, but it also addresses some of these really scientific challenges that you see in crop protection, things like acquired resistance and being able to even utilize certain modalities. There's a very exciting modality we all know about called RNAi. RNAi has been around and won the Nobel in 2006. It's, I think, invented and were discovered in 1999. But the methodology that was used to utilize RNAi was based on double-stranded RNA, which is a linear product, and it turns out had very poor what's called bioavailability. And so the development of RNAi was limited because you can eat and ingest RNA and it doesn't naturally go into cells. And it's a not something you can use as an active ingredient very well. Now, pharma was able to get around that and make some very exciting naturally derived pharmaceutical products, but they use chemistries and excipients and formulation techniques that you don't have the privilege of using in agriculture, and frankly, nor should we. But for us, we were able to, and this goes up back to some early days in my scientific career, reinvent the mechanisms of RNAi with a completely novel trigger. And what I mean by that is we don't use dsRNA. We don't use the typical version. We use a structural RNA that allows us to build scaffolding. And that scaffolding made of single-strand RNA still elicits the RNAi response, but allowed us to build nanoparticles in using RNA and plant proteins. And these particles, very much like a natural existing particle that might traverse a host cell, we can engineer this protein to deliver our RNA to a target insect very specifically. So it can work in certain lepidopteras, but not other lepidopteras, for instance, fall armyworm versus a butterfly, a butterfly. So it can be very specific. It's very challenging because of the specificity, but it is an exciting space in the sense that it opens up a new kind of forefront on what's possible for crop protection. So with this new technology, we'll be able to start addressing some of these big challenges in insect crop protection without using synthetic chemicals. And so for us, it's a very exciting time as we've validated the technology and now utilizing it in this manner. So
very interesting. We've heard about RNAi and various other technologies. And I'm sure many of our readers or listeners have heard about it and probably understand it, but some of them, like me, I'm a journalist, I'm not a scientist. So can you give me a layman's version of exactly what RNAi is?
Sure. RNAi is an antiviral response that exists in eukaryotic cells. To once a RNA has been detected that's viral, that RNA usually forms a dsRNA intermediate, and that stimulates the immune system of eukaryotic cells. Plants have it, insects, part of the animal kingdom have it, and humans. And this mechanism can be utilized. And what I think Andrew Fire had shown is that when there is a complementarity of the RNA to a target gene, it wouldn't necessarily have to be a viral target gene. It could be by changing the sequence, you can use it to target disease-causing genes. And a natural immunological mechanism can be used to target a disease-causing gene or any other gene, and that becomes very intriguing in terms of a mechanism. So RNAi has a very big and natural origin and a very big potential to it. And that's the mechanism we use, regardless, even though the RNA is different for triggering that mechanism. But RNAi is part of the natural antiviral defense system in eukaryotic cells.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned that pharmaceuticals have used RNAi for a number of years. I think I read on your website that it was hard, or it's been challenging, for RNAi to be find a meaningful impact in agriculture. Why has that been a challenge for agriculture?
It's a multifaceted challenge in the sense that RNAi has limited receptors on certain insects. So there's one class of insects that do respond well to RNAi from oral ingestion, but 85% of the insects that are economically valuable have no response to orally ingested RNA. And even though they have the mechanisms in their body and the natural immunology to support the use of that mechanism, getting it from the oral ingestion to the target cells is the challenge. And that challenge is multifaceted depending on the insect, whether it's complicated lepidopteral challenges like fall armyworm, the nucleases and proteases, and then you have this alkaline ingestion saliva that is very challenging from a biological standpoint, right? It's designed to dissolve. And then on the opposing side of that, you've got Hemiptera, like stink bug, where you have the opposite. You might have nucleases and proteases, but it's acidic, and so you get precipitation. So biologicals are challenging, and nature uses biologicals for its ongoing war between plants and insects. And insects adapt and change their digestive composure to fend against the plant's defenses. So we're playing in that space. We just found a way to engineer it and outpace the insect's ability to adapt. So we use these natural mechanisms, these natural methodologies of use of protein and RNA to overcome those barriers that had already evolved to avoid. And we take advantage of that speed at which we can deliver new composition to that insect that it's never seen. So let me give you an example. We might take a certain corn or a couple corn proteins and wrap them on the RNA in a way that is not typically experienced by the insect. So even though they're natural proteins that it's used to kind of ingesting one by one, when they're in an aggregate on a nanoparticle, it sort of changes the activity level of that protein. So we sort of accentuate the effect. And then we add a couple other components to it, a couple other proteins that help get the RNA into their gut cells in a natural way that can get to stimulate the RNAi effect. And it wouldn't have been possible if we were using the canonical long dsRNA, because when there's a challenge of bioavailability like we have with this, there's a window under 200 nanometers of physical size that a particle has to be. Linear dsRNA, if you make it longer and you start formulating, you get big globs of matter that are larger than that window of bioavailability. And so it was unusable. For us, building a scaffold that we can control is maybe a 50 nanometer diameter, and it's finite, it's programmed, it's locked in. When you coat it with the proteins, it's 100 nanometers, and it offers a very precise, almost pharmaceutical level of product development or of product for agricultural use. And all of these processes that we've designed and developed are self-forming. And so it can happen in a cell-free system, or it can happen in planta, just like it does in nature. And so we really engineered this to take advantage of a lot of features that make this possible and make it sustainable. Can't add formulation, we can't add downstream excipients and expensive purification processes. So we have a self-forming process that assembles our product made from mostly plant proteins that we utilize and then RNA. And for instance, we make everything here in a cell-free plant-derived system. So we experiment with different systems, or even experimenting with the use of weeds for the production of our bioreactors, so that we can make products in essentially weed material. And that's important, that it's a naturally derived system. And it wouldn't have been possible if we used the traditional RNAi. So it was very exciting for us to develop this system over the years. I wish I could say we were years ago looking forward and this is what we're going to solve, but it actually was serendipitous, the way everything happened, the trigger being fully different than the Nobel-winning system, the nanoparticles that are self-forming. We designed the system originally for biopharmaceuticals, and there is a massive convergence going on between the pharma space and the ag space, and the two are coming together in the sense that you can manufacture in interesting biological medicines and interesting bioagricultural products in planta and in plant-derived cell-free systems. And that's an exciting bigger trend or bigger occurrence than what I'm talking about here today. But we're in the right space at the right time, probably. You know, so
very good. So I guess I should have asked this earlier. How is this actually delivered? How does it end up getting to those target pests?
Yeah, and that's a great question. So for the most part, the products that we are developing are orally derived. There are possibilities that we'd have products that are more topical that go through different parts of the host insect. But for us, in our early stage product development, we are focused on orally derived products. Now, this technology, as you can imagine, isn't limited to insect crop protection. We're also focusing on plant-based crop protection and removing synthetic chemicals from herbicidal space. And so that, of course, is a topical application that goes to the stomata and into the plant cells. But the most interesting thing with the technology is the platform is it supports variations. So we can coat the nanoparticle with different proteins. And there's a kind of a golden rule in science that the surface of a nanoparticle determines its overall destination. So I'll give you a natural analogy. In the world of single-strand RNA viruses that infect insects and plants by the tens of thousands, there are many different types of capsid surfaces. And those capsid surfaces are naturally derived and they are selected for optimal penetration into certain plants or certain insects. And that's called tropism. And the RNA on the inside of those capsids can be wholly different and have a different function than the capsid on the outside. So by controlling the surface of that capsid, nature delivers those viruses, some of them symbiotic, some of them pesticidal, to different organisms. And that's that tropism effect is all dictated by the surface of the nanoparticle. So that golden rule applies to us as well. We just found a way to engineer it without being viral, without being infectious, that we can take advantage and structure the surface of our nanoparticles so that they have the features that are required for Lepidoptera, Hemiptera, Coleoptera, and whether it's topical or it's in planta or biological topical, or to target certain weed pests in the field as an herbicide. So I'm excited about where this is going forward. And it really goes towards solving how to bring RNAi modalities into agriculture, how to use these natural mechanisms effectively without adding cost, without adding chemical excipients, and making a sustainable food security system for all, since really what we're all about here.
You mentioned like sort of, I think the term you used was scaffolding. Is that the agrizone that's mentioned?
Yeah. So, I guess there's a lot of words we use to describe it, but the RNA on the inside is an interesting piece of RNA because it's a single-strand RNA that has all sorts of interesting structural features. So it forms on itself kind of like a origami or a scaffolding. So it builds a sphere-like structure, and that sphere-like structure has all sorts of little arms. At the same time, it is the active ingredient. The RNA has complementarity to the target genes, very specific at a pharmaceutical level of specificity, and holds the structure at the same time, acts as an assembly scaffolding for the agrizome. The agrizome is built on that RNA that forms, it builds a structure. It has little arms that stick off outside of that sphere that collect a protein. Now, the protein that we collect is driven by an aptamer to protein relationship. And so in a milieu of a slurry, we can co-express a corn protein and RNA, maybe three or four different proteins. And we, for the first time, can control the surface of the nanoparticle, sort of like a geography of a nanoparticle. So even though those are 50 nanometers, we're controlling which protein goes where and how many proteins go on the surface of the nanoparticle. Now that fundamentally is a new capability. And, I've been doing this for a long time. Traditionally in scientific formulation, you're mixing positively charged things with negatively charged things and sort of mixing up a concrete in a buffer and hoping your concrete's appropriately sized and you're trying to alter your buffers and your excipients so that you can get that structure. For us, we don't have to do that. The scaffolding controls that structure and it's self-assembling. And so it's a neat capability. We look at this, we test it with fluorescence, looking at green fluorescent protein and MGRI protein and watching the two assemble and form these particles. It's really a phenomenal thing. And I think we're really at this new capability is going to open all sorts of opportunities and uses in the field of agriculture and biopharmaceuticals, but it's a cool thing to see, right?
Sure. We've heard a lot about genetically modified crops. We've heard CRISPR, technology that the layperson seemed to be a bit afraid of. Is there a concern that when you start talking about technology and putting things on seeds or, into plants, into crops, that people might just kind of freak out, about this? Or is this not sort of in that same world?
Well, I think that the important thing is when I look at the food security problem and I think about sustainability and I think about what the threats are, I think about synthetic chemistries as my first de-risking part. So I think anything we can do to get rid of synthetic chemicals is important, but also being cognizant of people's concerns on GMO or the use of GMO. There's a couple of different aspects to this company that make it sort of unique. The products that we build are plant-derived. They don't have to be a GMO. We make plant cell-free systems that are making naturally derived products that we spray on topically. It has nothing to do with the genetics of a plant or making a heritable change to any organism. But that being said, the use of GMO and putting this product, this sort of technique into a plant could be very useful for protecting crops. Doesn't have to be food crops, but for utilizing natural mechanisms that already exist in the plant, take advantage of those in sort of emboldening them against their natural pests. Now, when we talk about mechanisms in the insects, these are natural mechanisms. We're not adding anything. And anything we add to the plant is not going to be heritable in a negative way. So we're taking advantage of the proteins it's already making in a way. So it's not something we're not adding proteins to the plant. And if we add RNA, the RNA that's in a plant is unquestionable. It's ubiquitous. RNA is part of nature. We're not by itself it's benign. So it has to have purpose. It has to be designed very specifically, and it's very challenging. And I would say the risk likely to, even looking back on traditional GMOs, the risk is questionable. I mean, there were a lot of early day fears on if you eat this product that had a different RNA in it, it was good to make you like Frankenstein or whatever. It's never happens. You can ingest RNA, you can eat it with everything you eat. Every piece of natural product, natural food item that you eat, it's filled with RNA. So it's not necessarily something that is going to affect you, but it is a concern from, that I understand amongst the public. And so for that, where there is question, we have topical products that are biologically derived that are useful. Industries like for Europe, for instance, where they don't allow GMOs, will use topicals. But where the GMO is possible in the sense of food security and cost and safety, it has a lot of interesting attributes that can't be ignored. And we owe a lot. We owe a lot, actually, to like the early days of Monsanto and what they had done in the industry. They put a lot of resources towards validating the technique, the safety of the technique, studying the safety of it with EPA over many years now. And so far, all the regulatory bodies, I think we can all rest assured that whatever goes to market is safe. And to me, that's the most important thing that we can do. And that's why we're in this space. But really, the real threat is synthetic chemistries. And that's the real issue that is scientifically valid in terms of its risk to human health. Right. And so that's where we're at. But we do address both markets.
Okay. Speaking of the synthetic, I mean, is this something you see down the road, whether it's 2 years, 10 years, 30 years from now, replacing synthetic? I mean, is that where we're ultimately headed?
That's the goal. And, synthetics have a leg up because of the potency. What makes them effective also is what makes them dangerous. They're small enough to traverse cell membrane. And so they can get into all sorts of off-target cells. And that's what makes them so potent? So for us, the challenge is within the barriers of biologicals, making our biologicals potent enough to compete with synthetic potency and then have all the benefits of sustainability and safety on the biological side. And so I do believe that we will solve this, and not just me, but there's a lot of brilliant people in the industry working on the problem. They have all sorts of solutions that they've come up with. We're just part of this process that's going on, right? So I'm very positive that this is the likely outcome, and there's a lot of resources being put into making it so. Everybody wants food security, and everybody wants safe food. It's interesting, you know, sort of watch the media for, like you, over a number of years, decades even, and also having known these executives and scientists at large multinational agricultural companies, these guys are working day in and day out to make food safe and affordable. And they are doing some amazing work. Yes, there's been lessons learned from 25 years ago, 15 years ago, but where this industry is going now, if you look at where Corteva is going, and I can't speak for any of these companies, but from my view, it definitely looks like biologicals, naturally derived products, is a big emphasis on their product pipeline going forward. And so that's so fitting with Trillium. Trillium is all about that as well. So I think there's a nice convergence in several areas that I mentioned earlier. And I think there's reasons for optimism as a grower, as a farmer, even as a consumer, and that your food will be safe.
Sure. Technology often outpaces the regulatory environment. I mean, we're looking at, you know, like things like ChatGPT, the artificial intelligence stuff that we're hearing a lot about right now. For people that are listening, that's kind of what's in the topic a lot of the news today. But where does this fit into the regulatory environment? I know different countries have different...
Right. Different countries have different... approaches. Plus, different compositions have different regulatory implications. For instance, as you mentioned, if we make a trait-based product, I think you referred to it as GMO, that has a different regulatory life cycle than does a topical. And the topicals are much shorter, it's easier to get to market because, you know, you simply show that it's made in something that doesn't spread disease and it's made in naturally derived proteins. And typically, those things we make are made for products that are what are called GRAS, generally regarded as safe. And so the regulatory hurdles on the topicals are much lower. That being said, there's greenhouse trials, there's field trials, there's a lot of safety studies that go into anything just to make sure you don't miss something, right? Even if it's not required by the regulatory body, everything is studied. So we do have to comply with regulatory systems, and we fit right in, and we haven't talked about this, but Trillium is probably not a company you're going to see a product from in the near future. You're likely to see our technology inside existing products from larger companies that have the distribution and the regulatory scale to handle and support that deregulatory process. So Trillium as it is more of a technology provider, kind of like a Intel inside sort of capability. But that being said, we're not against developing product and going through the deregulatory process with a product to take it to market. And there's a lot of exciting opportunities that this technology, I think, will bring, especially some new product categories that might have more or less easier process to market simply because the natural nature of our product development.
Okay. I sort of led right into my next question, which is, you know, where are you in the development phase and how soon might we see something that uses this technology available to the growers?
Yeah. And so, you know, as I mentioned in the early part of our call is, you know, the technology has been under development for a number of years, and Trillium was sort of in stealth mode for 6 years, validating the RNA, the assembly, the protein, basically the agrosome platform. So we're in an inflection point, a turning point where we just moved from technology development into product composition development. And so this is an exciting time for us because now the rubber hits the road. We have in our pipeline a product for fall armyworm, for stink bug, for acquired resistant Coleoptera, and we're developing these products. And I'd say we're a year away from field trial. And so once we get to that, then it depends on partners and deregulatory processes, how soon you'll see it. But it's still a number of years away.
You mentioned a few of the targets you have right now, the fall armyworm, the stink bug. I think Palmer amaranth was on your website as well. And you mentioned earlier that finding the right target, the way that I'm probably going to mischaracterize this, so please correct me if I'm wrong here, but you know, that the don't know if it's the biology of a given pest, this sort of works better for them, or you can at least target a specific cells in those particular pests. I mean, is it going to ultimately become something that can be used for on any pest, hopefully, or at least many, many more pests?
So, and that's a thank you for highlighting that question there. The answer to that is the reason we chose our pipeline targets, fall armyworm, stink bug, and acquired resistant Coleoptera, is that the challenges that are intrinsic in each one of these insects represent failure points in the industry, the traditional RNAi industry. So they couldn't target Hemiptera. They were ineffective against fall armyworm, and it led the only one Monsanto dsRNA product to make it to market, led to quick acquired resistance in Western corn rootworm. So the reason we targeted those three is to demonstrate the capabilities of this platform that highlight its features over the past failures. It by no means limits what we'll be able to do with the technology. So yes, we would target eventually all economically valid pests, whether they're viral, fungal, insect, and plant with the same technology. And so, so we're just demonstrating without coming out of the gate with products that are designed to demonstrate the efficacy where everyone else has failed would be a great way to start. Now, that being said, fall armyworm was also chosen because it's a $37 billion problem. It is a national emergency on two continents, and it's an insect and represents a class of insects that cause significant damage to crops. And so there's economic drivers for that as well as scientific demonstration.
Sure. This has really been fascinating. And just so people know, Trillium is T-R-I-L-L-I-U-M, and it's Trillium Ag, right?
Right. Yeah, they can email info@trilliumag.com, and that is also on the website, and they can ping us, and then we'll open up a direct dialogue with one of our team members from there.
I appreciate your time today. We've been talking with Todd Hauser, co-founder and CEO of Trillium Ag, who have developed or working on developing RNAi solutions to treat specific pests. Any other last thoughts?
You know, Dan, thank you very much for having me today. If there's another opportunity to come back and see you again as we get close to product release, I would love to do so.
Thank you for listening to the Ag Tech Talk podcast from Agribusiness Global. You can find more podcasts, videos, news, e-newsletters, event and webinar information at agribusinessglobal.com.